Good evening, everyone. Tonight's topic for this concluding lecture of this series is a vision for the future of religious Zionism, or, as I called it in some of the announcements, towards a non-delusional religious Zionism. And I actually hope to explain actually quite clearly what I mean by that. That's not just sort of throwing around a term of opprobrium. I actually really want to be clear about what I mean both by delusional religious Zionism and by non-delusional religious Zionism. I want to begin tonight by talking about someone whose name has come up a couple of times in the course of this series, a man named Moshe Una. Moshe Una, to repeat something I said during one of the early lectures, began his career as one of the leaders of Mizrahi in Germany, one of the young religious Zionist leaders in Germany. He, born in 1902, he makes Aliyah in 1927 and becomes one of the leaders of the religious kibbutz movement and in general of religious Zionist socialism. And the truth is, I should say by way of, you know, apology, if you think six lectures is a lot, one of the central themes in religious Zionism that I simply, by dint of the brevity, I have not been able to talk about at all is the various attempts to marry Zionism and socialism among religious thinkers, which is a major theme in the history of religious Zionism, and maybe for another day. Moshe Una serves in the first five Knessets, including as a member of the National Religious Party, that is the Mafdal, and at one point becomes the Deputy Minister of Education and Culture. In 1988, as an 86-year-old man, he leaves the Mafdal and runs for Knesset on the Meimad party line, on the party of the religious Zionist left in Israel. And I want to spend a minute talking about Moshe Una because the notion that the person I'm going to now describe could have been a member of parliament from the National Religious Party is, in a sense, astonishing and unimaginable in today's religious Zionist world. In 1945, 3 years before the state still, Moshe Una writes an essay called Hachnuch B'Chayenu, Education in Our Lives. And this relatively obscure essay has a couple of aspects to it that I think are really striking and that I want to use to begin our conversation tonight. Una begins his discussion of religious Zionist education by advocating for what he calls humanism Yehudi, Jewish humanism. He is unabashed about his humanistic values being universalistic ones. Arachim musariim v'tarbutiim hayotzrim yachas la'olam v'la'enoshut. Moral and cultural values that create relationships with the entire world and with all of humanity. He argues that those values are at the very foundation of religious education in general and religious Zionist education in particular. Jews can arrive at this humanism, he says, through learning Torah, but it is universal and thus independent of Torah. That is, one can arrive at those values from other means than Torah as well. To be clear, the term humanism in our culture means things that it doesn't mean to him. This is not humanism in the sense of putting the human being rather than God in the center, what we often think of as secular humanism. This is humanism in the sense of an uncompromising commitment to universal human well-being and to responsibility to the whole human community as a fundamental commitment to what it means to be a person, right? It's moral humanism, it's not secular humanism, right? In fact, he would say, if asked, this is theological humanism. It's humanism rooted in monotheism. One God entails universal morality. Now, Moshe Hellinger, a contemporary scholar of religious Zionism, comments that what's interesting about Una's approach is that he essentially creates a two-tiered identity structure in which the universal and humanistic is the first floor and the national Jewish is the second floor. And what is most striking about Una is that he is totally unapologetic about the fact that he wants to interpret the text and values of the second floor in light of the commitments of the first floor. That is, Torah needs to be interpreted, he says, based on our commitment to theological humanistic values. Now, this is actually very important because many religious Zionist thinkers internalized various aspects of modernity, but few of them were willing to admit it, or were willing to admit the extent of it. Una is exceptional in this way, in that he actually sees no reason to be embarrassed about the thoroughgoing modernism of his understanding of traditional Judaism. And he would be the first to emphasize, this is not reform, this is not conservative, this is traditional Judaism. And traditional Judaism is, at its heart, a humanistic undertaking. He ends his discussion, and this is one of the reasons why this otherwise obscure essay is actually, I think, worth pausing on. He ends his discussion of education with a throwaway comment that is actually kind of amazing. He's talking about Humanism Yehudi, Jewish humanism, and he ends by saying, I want to one more time underline the word humanism and not al pi ha-Torah, not according to the Torah. Why, he says, yesh tzorech b'hadgasha al hamila humanism, it is important to emphasize the word humanism, v'lo maspik lomar al pi ha-Torah, and it's not enough to say a worldview based on Torah. And this is the incredibly important phrase, ki min ha-Torah afshar lilmod dvarim shonim, because from Torah you can learn all kinds of things. Shivim panim la-Torah, he says, there are 70 faces of Torah, and he's not talking here about 70 positive faces. He's talking about 70 faces, some of which are beyond the moral pale. Efshar lilmod mimena, he says, afilu et hachiyuv la-teror, kifi shemishu nisal hochiach. You can even learn from Torah the obligation to be a terrorist, as some have sought to prove. Hamila humanism ba'al faresh v'levarer al eza arachim mibein ha'arachim harabim hanimtzaim b'sikruteinu anu shoafim levaseis et hachinuch. The word humanism, he says, comes to explain and to make absolutely clear which values among the many that are found in our literature we aspire to establish as the basis of our commitment to education. What this means, I think, is that Una is saying something actually quite profound, if sort of subtly and quickly. That is, that you can't pretend to derive your values from a simple, straight reading of Torah, since Torah, in the broadest sense, contains multitudes, and can be read to advocate universal humanism on the one hand, and radically particularistic chauvinism on the other, and of course, anything and everything in between. And all of those views will actually have some pretty interesting and authoritative texts to support them. And Una's suggestion is that we confront that rather than kidding ourselves about it. This, I think, is an attempt, by the way, both to make liberals think more complicatedly about their own approach to tradition and to make chauvinists less hyper-confident in their interpretations of Torah. You need, in other words, a hermeneutic. You need a guiding principle of interpretation. And for Una, that principle is what I'm calling Jewish theological humanism. In other words, it's not, and I would actually make this point totally separate from Zionism, it's not that some people read selectively, prioritizing some things and demoting others, while others don't. It's that some people are honest about it, and others are not. That's, I think, a very basic, critical principle you should have in thinking about modern Jewish appropriations of text, whether Haredi or Reform or anything in between. There's a third point in this essay that I want to emphasize, and it's a central concern of Una's throughout his career. At one point, and remember, we're now in 1945, Una is discussing the need to instill in children an attachment to their homeland, Hamoledet. But immediately, he adds a really interesting caveat. He says that children must also be taught what he calls the unique problematic that attaches to this particular homeland, namely, that the land of Israel is a homeland for two peoples. Interestingly, he talks about two peoples, not the Jewish people and some Arabs who live there, but two peoples. He writes, quote, The student must understand the neighboring nation, which is also connected to the land, and not see it as a mere enemy or competitor. That is, he says, a central piece of what it means to be educated Jewishly, is to understand the depth of your own attachment to the land, but also to understand the depth of attachment to the land of another people. Crucially, again, just to reiterate this point, not just understanding individuals, as many Zionists say, but actually understanding a competing national claim. In general, Una, like other Zionist thinkers we heard about in the fourth lecture on violence and militarism, was afraid that secular Jewish nationalism was in danger of co-opting traditional religious ideas like covenant, messianism, and chosenness for a baldly chauvinistic and militaristic nationalistic agenda. Religious Zionists, he thought, needed to band together to fight off this process, which he regarded as collective assimilation. That is, Jewish people taking on the values of brutal and militaristic cultures and calling that Judaism. We saw, for example, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, say very similar things, that religious Zionists need to be the moral watchguard over the dangers of using Torah language to justify chauvinistic agendas. Jewish militarism, Una says, is a contradiction in terms, an attempt to integrate poison, Ra'al, he says, into Zionism, an integration that he warns over the course of his long career again and again and again would lead to the moral destruction of the Zionist project. Una goes so far as to say at one point that leaving Galut, while important, is also dangerous, because a whole new level of ethical conflict emerges and a whole new level of ethical violation on our part becomes possible. That is not a reason to avoid it, he says, but it is a reason to be vigilant and consistently self-critical. Now, we saw the two pulls in Rav Kook, the father. On the one hand, warnings about the dangers of nationalism, and on the other hand, confidence that Israel's segula, its unique attachment to God, will prevent its moral degeneration. Plus, confidence also that since the Messianic age is upon us, everything is now different. Una, in short, shares all of Rav Kook's anxieties about the danger and none of his confidence that somehow the Jewish people are immune to this process of deterioration. Right? He is sort of a mochiach bashar, a critic in the gate, at the gate, saying, this is important, this is necessary, this is also extremely dangerous. Now, the irony, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, is precisely that it's religious Zionist circles, particularly the circles influenced by Tzvi Yehuda Kook, it's there that Jewish terms like covenant, chosenness, messianism become caught up in a hyper-chauvinist and hyper-militaristic vision of Zionism. In other words, the religious Zionist thinkers who thought that the goal of religious Zionism, or one of the central tasks of religious Zionism, was to warn against militarism, those very circles actually became the most militaristic circles in religious Zionism. And that's a sort of tragic irony of how religious Zionism unfolded in light of Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Una is very explicit in the way that we were, that there are two versions of religious Zionism, the messianic redemptive on the one hand, and the realistic life-saving on the other. And he, again and again, unequivocally sides with the second, the realistic life-saving version of Zionism, and insists that pikuach nefesh, the aspiration to save Jewish lives, is not only the best argument for Zionism, but it is also, and this is really crucial, the operative principle in determining matters of state and religion. Right? The ultimate criterion by which you decide religiously how to make a decision is, will it save lives? In general, and this is where Una, in a way, is a segue. For a few minutes I'd like to spend on Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Una argues that the dangerous failure of religious Zionism is that it has failed to maintain a distinction between the ideal and the real. That failure to maintain a distinction between what you ideally desire and what is really possible has dangerous and often disastrous consequences. There are a bunch of examples in the course of his writing. For example, if we start with a kind of more moderate example, he calls on the religious Zionist camp at various points to stop talking about establishing a Torah state. A huge preoccupation of religious Zionists, especially right after the founding of the state. He says, I just want to point out to you that an enormous majority of the Jewish people living in this state find that language not only not appealing, but actively terrifying. You might can it. It's not helpful and not real. Another example we saw in the second lecture is that Una argues strongly for the instrumental as opposed to the ontological meaning of the land of Israel. The return to the land makes possible the redemption and transformation of individual Jewish lives and lives of Jewish society. But an obsession with the metaphysical nature of the land, he warns, can only lead to disastrous political consequences. It's crucial to add here that Una points out, this is a critique from the grave, as it were, that God's promises in the Bible about ultimate messianic borders have no, and were never intended to have, any implications at all for current political decision-making. They are precisely that, an ultimate promise from God, not a political project. More fundamentally, he says, you cannot make political decisions based on abstract metaphysical commitments. If you do, you will end up in the abyss. Now, I just want to say one kind of last thing about Una, which is that for him, a commitment to realism is coupled with a commitment and a preoccupation to ethics. Already in 1947, Una writes that Zionism faces a fateful choice. You can think only about your own wants and needs, he says, or you can let ethics and questions about how one treats the other have a major say in politics and the future of the state. He warns repeatedly, you cannot solve the problem of the tension between your religious yearnings and ideals and the reality of the ethical obligations in front of you by simply wishing or willing that tension away. It's not going to go away, even and especially if you don't confront it. For Una, this meant, throughout his career, that he was ready and willing to consider dismantling settlements for the sake of peace. This, he argued, was not ultimately a religious compromise, but as he puts it, as a religious person, my highest ideal is the pursuit of peace. Isn't it possible, he says, that from a theological perspective, the Arabs have a major place in God's plans for us? And finally, he suggests, our claim to the land may be a mitzvah, but it is not by any means, and there's no precedent for suggesting that it is a mitzvah that outweighs and overrides all others. It says something about where religious Zionism has come that if I said to the average religious Zionist, passionate religious Zionist, age 21, who is Moshe Una? They would look at me and say, I don't know. Guy who owns the Makolet, I'm not sure. I have no idea who that is, right? It's very telling. And there's a whole line of people in this genre who have been completely eclipsed in the process of the Tzvi Yehudaization of religious Zionism. Now, before moving to my own suggestions for what religious Zionism ought to look like, I want to say something by sort of point of contrast in a way that brings together a lot of what we talked about in the first four lectures. And that is how religious Zionism went wrong. And here, obviously, I'm talking in the first person. The first overarching problem, right? And in the end, I think it is the problem that generates almost all others. The first overarching problem is what we called ontological essentialism. which in modern academic Hebrew is often rendered as mahutanut, right? The notion of essentialism. As we saw, Tzvi Yehuda Cook's essentialism took two forms. First, the idea that the Jewish people are ontologically distinct from the rest of humanity. On this view, the difference between Jews and Gentiles is one of hardware rather than software. That is, Jews are not distinct merely by dint of having received the Torah and having a different cultural and religious heritage, but rather by dint of something built into the very substance and fabric of who we are. In the language of the history of Jewish thought, ontological essentialism is the choice of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi as opposed to Maimonides. Now, scholars debate about whether or not it makes sense or it's anachronistic to call medieval versions of this essentialism racism. But for our purposes, I think what matters is, A, that whether or not it makes sense to call it racism, it very easily morphs into racism, and B, it is a very different thing to hold an ontologically essentialist view of Jewishness when you are powerless and writing poetry and philosophy versus writing in that vein when you have an army and tanks. The consequences of thinking in those ways are extremely different. And the pervasiveness of this kind of essentialism is actually overwhelming. Now, I actually have to say I hesitate about giving you the examples that I'm about to give you because I actually find it hard to say these things. But I think it's actually important for confronting the reality of where we are. In April 2008, Mordechai Eliyahu, not a student of Tzvi Yehuda Cook's, but similarly influenced by similar Kabbalistic ideas, then, in 2008, the former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel declares, after the terrorist attack on the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva, quote, "The life of one yeshiva boy is worth more than the lives of 1,000 Arabs." And I just would point out that more than 100,000 people participated in Mordechai Eliyahu's funeral. And he is, in many religious Zionist contexts, really kind of seen as the Admor, the Hasidic Rebbe of a certain kind of large pockets of the religious Zionist world. Or, just last month, Hebron spokesman David Wilder offered the following insight. "The ultimate responsibility for the horrific murder of the Fogel family," he said, "lies with," quote, I want you to hear this quote, "Jewish leaders who are willing to again abandon our land and our people, returning all the heavily Arab-populated cities in Judea and Samaria to monkeys dressed up as people." To monkeys dressed up as people. Kofim b'tzurat b'nei adam. That's ontological essentialism number one and its consequences. The second ontologically essentialist claim is that the land of Israel is not just a piece of land, and not even just a piece of land chosen by God, but it is rather, as we saw, some kind of metaphysical substance. Recall Rav Kook the Father's irrationalist take on the nature of Eretz Yisrael. The land of Israel, he argued, can be understood only as Eretz HaRazim, the land of secrets. The land, and say for the notion of Razim actually immediately invokes Kabbalistic terminology. It can only be understood in abstract metaphysical concepts. Tzvi Yehuda, as was his way, popularizes and intensifies his father's ideas and offers these, as we saw, dramatic formulations of the unity of land and nation. Ha-hadadiyut ha-elohit, the divine mutuality, shel chelek enoshut zeh, v'chelek geografi zeh, between this divine piece of land and this divine piece of humanity. What they constitute, he says, in good Kabbalistic language, is a zivug Elohi, a divine coupling. The metaphysical unity of the land means that it cannot be broken up. No human being has the authority to act in a way that compromises the metaphysical integrity of the land. All of this theology leads to Tzvi Yehuda's introduction of the term af sha'al, not one inch. And as we saw, leads him to pronouncements such as to surrender 1 millimeter, literally one shoelace, sroch na'al, of the land of Israel constitutes a violation of Yehareg va'al yavor. You should sooner be killed then abandon 1 centimeter of the land of Israel. And sure enough, Tzvi Yehuda then argues that any human decision that undermines the unity of the land is null and void and has no standing. Okay? So we have these two forms of ontological essentialism. And then we have, second or third, depending on how you're counting, messianic maximalism. Which means, essentially, that you end up sanctifying and even divinizing the state, such that Tzvi Yehuda can talk about Medina Yisrael as Medina Elohit, a divine state. Now, if you talk about the state as a divine state, I want to suggest that there are only two possibilities that result. One is you give the state a total moral blank check, as in the moments when we see Tzvi Yehuda say things like, well, the state of Israel can do little things that may not be agreeable, but its essence is pure and holy, and it can never be compromised, because it is what it is. It is pure holiness, pure metaphysical holiness. Or you turn on the state with a vengeance when it doesn't do what you insist is the will of God. What that means, as I have suggested in a couple of lectures, is that Tzvi Yehuda and his circle actually end up holding both of these views at the same time. Right? They move between assuming that the state, insisting that the state is metaphysically perfect, and deriding the state as fundamentally illegitimate. And in some ways you could say that the fundamental divide among the circle of Tzvi Yehuda students now is which of those poles they dilate on, which of those poles they think is most operative. There's the Mamlachtiyut camp, this camp that says, no, the state is absolutely holy, and whatever it says is on some level holy, even if we don't understand it. That's the sort of Tzvi Tau, Shlomo Aviner crowd. And then you have people who have moved far beyond, right, who will say things like, the state is, in some fundamental way, illegitimate. And that's what I called, and I forget the second lecture, I think, right-wing post-Zionism, right, where the state has now fundamentally been abandoned. Now, some people who have been around this yeshiva at various points have heard me rant and rave about how I'm opposed to theologies that are what I have called overly immanentist, too focused on divine immanence. And people often think, what's the big deal? Why are you so invested in this like obscure metaphysical question? And I actually want to suggest that this is a really good example of why this is not just a metaphysical question. This has huge ethical and political consequences. If your theology allows you to say that God and what is are so intertwined that they're almost inseparable, then you have unavoidably sanctified the status quo. You've actually absolutized the status quo. What the transcendence of God does is relativize everything that is found on earth. God is above and beyond, and therefore stands in judgment over every earthly status quo. And it's no surprise that scholars of religious Zionism have argued that the theological innovation of religious Zionism is the radical focus on divine immanence in history. And it's a really good example of how dangerous that really is. It's not just about whether someone puts up a postcard that says this postcard is God, right? It's actually about something much deeper and more important than that, which is, ultimately, is there anything in this world that is already divine? And Tzvi Yehuda's Zionism is a really interesting example of what happens when you let that take root. Determinism is related here, right? In that, as we saw, Tzvi Yehuda's Zionism, his messianism is totally determinist, meaning it does not depend on how we act. This is a radical departure from the teachings of his father. That determinism means, basically, a total recklessness in international affairs, since, after all, God will protect us. And you find people making these comments explicitly. Who cares what the rest of the world thinks? In fact, maybe it's good if we can initiate some kind of war that will force God's hand, and God will therefore make the demographic arrangements that we long for. Right? So the determinism, basically, is a way of eschewing any kind of moral responsibility for my own behavior. And finally, We have, as we saw in the fourth lecture, an unequivocal theological celebration of militarism. And here I want to stop and say a couple of things. Remember that pre-state Zionists were not quite pacifistic, but not so far from it. So Rav Reines, founder of Mizrahi, insists on the absolute dichotomy between the culture of the book on the one hand and the culture of the sword on the other, and that the meaning of the Jewish people in history is to be a pocket of the culture of the book that rejects the culture of the sword until the Messianic age, when God lets the culture of the book rule the world. The victory of Sefer over Saif, the victory of the book over the sword. Or Rav Kook, the father, who makes an absolute distinction between what he calls the voice of Jacob and the hands of Esav. That cannot be integrated. No peace is possible between them. So, again, imagine the difference, the distance traveled between those positions and Tzvi Yehuda's declaration that the army is holy, or the Gush Emunim claim that a military tank is as holy as a pair of tefillin, or, in the line from Tzvi Yehuda that I talked about at some length, the notion that the acquisition of weapons brings the Shekhinah back into the world. Tzvi Yehuda goes so far as to say, God's presence is imminent in the world precisely in the military power of the Jewish people. And as we saw, he goes even one step farther to say the meaning of Chilul Hashem, its primary meaning, is not about ethics or interpersonal relationships. The primary meaning of Chilul Hashem is the lack of Jewish sovereignty over the land. Allowing the land to be in control of anybody else is the ultimate definition of the desecration of God's name. Now, I imagine that Tzvi Yehuda Circle would not be pleased with this description, but this is exactly what Moshe Una was talking about when he talked about collective assimilation. It's exactly this, right? That is, the Jewish people taking on the very worst values that they spent history condemning in everybody else. Now, Yoske Achituv, one of the important figures of the religious kibbutz movement in this generation, has said that Tzvi Yehuda's approach constitutes delusional religious Zionism. Tzionut datit ashlayatit. Achituv is moved by a broader approach to metaphysics that I can't and won't get into here, but I want to use that language to point specifically to what is fundamentally delusional and therefore not plausible, right, in Tzvi Yehuda's understanding of Zionism. Right? The delusionality plays itself out primarily in two fundamental ways. One, it claims to know the inner workings of God's mind, the inner workings of God's plans for history, and even how God would vote in a given election. Right? It insists that it knows all those things with absolute certitude. So much so that it's perhaps not surprising for those of you interested in the history of rabbinics that it's precisely in the circle of Tzvi Yehuda Kook that the Haredi idea of Da'at Torah ends up eventually adopted, right? The notion that there are some sages who really have absolute access to the truth, right? That idea is in some ways antithetical to early religious Zionists, many of whom saw themselves as rebelling against the authority of rabbis. Second, the second form of delusionality is the insistence that, as we saw last week, secular Zionists are simply not who or what they say they are, and that I know better than they what their inner life ultimately consists of. What that means in pure ethical terms is that you can't ultimately learn from or engage with the other, because there is no other. The other is merely you, but only less self-aware. And then when the other fails to live up to your expectation of who the other is, you turn potentially violent, either verbally or physically. In general, I think it's fair to say that Tzvi Yehuda's circle is marked by an inability and an unwillingness to see the other, whether secular Zionists, whether Gentiles in general, whether Arabs in Eretz Yisrael in particular. So many of Tzvi Yehuda's students talk, if you read their drashot, as if non-Jews were merely created to be bit players on the stage of Jewish history. or as Zvi Tal wonderfully says, the Palestinian people exist only to be defeated by the Jewish people. That is, after all, one more piece of, now we're not in ontological essentialism anymore, we're in out-and-out racism. So, as you might have gathered, I am not sympathetic to this vision of religious Zionism. Not just because I think it's immoral, but also because it is, I'm not sure this is the right use of the word, it is inoperable, meaning it leads inevitably to an inability to function in reality and in history. It means that people end up living in a narrative that is exclusively theirs, so that if you were to ask someone in Tzvi Yehuda's circle to analyze Israeli history over the last 20 years, and you were to ask anybody else to analyze the same facts, you would literally have two totally different universes unfolding before you. There's no ability to create a conversation outside of this, what Achituv calls this ashlaya, this delusion of what's actually going on. So, in light of that, what would a different religious Zionism, Tzionut Datit Acheret, or as Achituv wonderfully calls it, Tzionut Datit Bilti Ashlayatit, non-delusional religious Zionism, what would that look like? I'm defending myself by pointing out that the term delusional religious Zionism is not mine, much as I wish it were. So, I'm going to suggest that the starting point for this religious Zionism is to read Genesis 1. A story of Jewish national origins, that is the Torah, and Jewish national destiny. And yet, the Torah makes a choice not to begin the story with the creation of Avraham, but rather with the creation of Adam, and not to begin with the creation of Eretz Yisrael, but rather with the creation of the whole earth. What the biblical scholar John Levinson calls the universal horizon of all biblical particularism. The universal horizon of all biblical particularism. That is, there is an active decision, right? Many cultures tell a story of origins, and it's a story of the origin of their culture. And actually, the decision of the Torah is to tell a story of origin that is about humanity and the world, and not first the story of the Jewish people and its land. What's more central in this context is what amounts to the first principle of Tzionut Datit Acheret, of a different religious Zionism, that is, the total rejection of ontological essentialism. What differentiates the Jewish people and the rest of the world is software, not hardware. A return, that is, to the Rambam, and an abandonment of Yehuda Halevi as morally unacceptable in an age when Jews have power. Now, what is the meaning, in that case, of the land of Israel? In a post-ontologically essentialist conception, that is, that the land of Israel is holy because it is the place where Torah and mitzvot, and Jewish culture more broadly for that matter, can be played out and fulfilled. I will say more about what I do and don't mean by that in a little while. Now, perhaps you've had the experience of getting off an El Al plane or arriving at the Kotel and having the sense, perhaps you've also had the disappointment of expecting yourself to have this sense and not had it, which is also a common experience, right? But perhaps you had the sense, no, this place is a different order of being from any place I've ever been. It is intrinsically holy. It is ontologically unique. Many Jews report that experience as the most powerful religious experience they've ever had. And I would suggest that we understand these experiences, that we insistently understand these experiences in phenomenological terms rather than metaphysical ones. In other words, they describe our experience, the too low, right? And nothing else. They describe the way we experience this place as metaphysically unique. But they make no metaphysical claims. To make a sort of just Kantian throwaway, we do, after all, live after Kant. And we should be a little hesitant about assuming that our intuitions of metaphysics are necessarily access to metaphysical truths. You may recall from the second lecture that the contemporary scholar Dov Schwartz interprets those rare occasions when Rabbi Soloveitchik seems to speak of the land in metaphysical terms as descriptions, evocations of a subjective consciousness, not a claim about objective reality. Rabbi Soloveitchik is a good example, as we saw, of someone who makes no claim at all for the metaphysical status of the land beyond being a place where, in his language, the halakha can be played out as it can be played out nowhere else. So to the question of militarism and force, and here is, you know, the knottiest part of articulating any Zionism, let alone, in certain ways, a religious Zionism. Things have changed a lot, to say the least, since the times of Rav Reines and Rav Kook. After the Holocaust, we understand more than ever, or at least we should, that moral responsibility sometimes requires the use of force. But we should be clear here. Military force is a necessary evil, something we have no choice but to embrace. Therefore, we have to do it carefully and self-critically, lest we become like the enemies we rightly condemn. A necessary evil means, in other words, that it is not l'chadchila, it is not a manifestation of God's presence in the world. A military tank is not holy, it's a military tank, which means it's necessary. Weapons do not increase the divine presence in Israel, they merely save Jewish lives. And I say merely in quotation marks. That is to say, they have value. When they are held up as metaphysical ideals, that's a total descent from Judaism's ideals. And I can, if it's interesting, during question and answers, kind of create a litany of rabbinic sources that I think would make that very claim. Here, I want to make clear, I am parting ways with both A, what I'll call leftist purists, who think that any embrace of power by Jews is anathema. This, to my mind, is an immoral position to hold after Auschwitz, and at any rate, it's easier to advocate for this in Berkeley than in Birkenau. And B, of course, I'm also parting ways with Tzvi Yehuda's circle and its celebration, sanctification, lechatchilaization of military force. The role of the Holocaust, in other words, in thinking about power, is dialectical. The role of the Holocaust is dialectically to legitimate and critique Jewish power. The Holocaust means, on the one hand, that Jewish power is morally urgent and necessary, and also that Jews have an obligation to be totally vigilant about the dangers and potential damage that taking power can do. Now let me add, just so I can upset some people, that since I've offered some blistering criticisms of delusionality on the right, I want to point out that there is delusional messianism of sorts on the left as well. Many on the left talk as if, for example, Israel has no enemies, as if the only thing standing in the way of peace in the Middle East is Israeli recalcitrance. If we just dismantled the settlements, there would be peace on earth, and Shimon Peres' old vision of a new Middle East would blossom before us. Now, I can't go on at length about this, though I wish I could, but I'm going to offer one quote from the last month that embodies what I'll call the willful delusionality I'm talking about. Judith Butler, the following sentence in a recent speech, and I quote, "Yes, understanding Hamas and Hezbollah as social movements that are progressive, that are on the left, that are a part of the global left, is extremely important," end quote. She might be reminded that a Hamas state would murder all gays and lesbians within its first founding hours. Wishful thinking, in other words, does not make it so. And there's a reason why some sociologists have actually done studies which win them lack of friends on both sides of right-wing religious Zionism and extreme left-wing post-Zionism as in some ways mirror phenomena, that is, each animated by a certain delusional sense of the world really looks like I wish it did. The fourth piece of Atzionut Datit Acheret, we'll say this unequivocally, is that Zionism is not about messianism, and in fact has nothing to do with messianism. As we saw Rav Reines in one lecture, and the Member of Parliament Pinchas Rosenblit in another lecture say, the one empirical test of whether or not we are living in the Messianic Age is whether or not there are wars. This, Rosenblit pointed out in late 1967, might serve as a reminder that we are not living in the Messianic Age. It is, this is now me talking, not him, quite self-evidently delusional, I would say, to claim that we're living in Messianic times when buses are blowing up and when you are dropping bombs on your enemies. By the way, that's true even if you're always justified in dropping those bombs. Right? The Messianic claim is not that one day there will only be just wars. It is that one day there will be no more wars. And during a time when you're at war, let alone that large chunks of the world are at war, to talk about it being the Messianic era is to live in some construction of your own making. It also, of course, turns a blind eye to the degree of war, bloodshed, oppression, and suffering that pervade human experience throughout the globe, which is, I would suggest, no small thing if you believe in Genesis 1 and God's concern for all humanity. But we've seen again and again just how dangerous and explosive messianism can be, especially in its deterministic forms. So, fifth, what does Zionism mean if it's not messianism? And here I want to acknowledge the deep influence of Rabbi David Hartman. First and foremost, Zionism and the emergence of a Jewish state represent an opportunity unprecedented in literally thousands of years for the Jewish people to live out a full Jewish life, to live out Torah, mitzvot, and Jewish culture, not merely in the privacy of their homes or synagogues, but in the public sphere and in the marketplace. This opportunity, of course, is also a huge challenge. Can the Jewish people create a model society rooted in the Torah's ideals of compassion, love, and justice? Can halakha really play a useful role in fashioning a modern society? And I would also add, does the Jewish people have leaders courageous enough to interpret the tradition along the lines that Una suggests, rather than the lines that Tzvi Yehuda Cook and those like him suggest? Does the Jewish people have the courage to actually decide who its poskim are by their values, rather than by the content of their memory? Right? A huge failing across the board in Jewish life, where one imagines that a gadol b'Torah, a great Jewish sage, is defined by how much they can quote by heart. Where one would actually choose one's religious leaders based on the moral values they articulate, the theological vision they both articulate and embody, rather than by their memory. Related to this, in terms borrowed from Joseph Soloveitchik, the Jewish people have a unique opportunity in light of the state, not just to be passive, but to be active, to take responsibility for our own fate as well as for our own destiny. This, I want to suggest, is what it means to say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzma'ut. It is a declaration of what joy it is finally to have an opportunity that we were robbed of for thousands of years. The state of Israel, in other words, is a challenge primarily, rather than an answer, or if you prefer, an opportunity, rather than something already achieved. This requires, in other words, religious sobriety, rather than messianic fervor. Or, to use my own language for a minute, the joy of Hallel on Yom Ha'atzma'ut is simcha shel mitzvah, and not simcha shel geula, is the joy of being commanded, rather than the joy of having been redeemed. I'm reminded of something that in a different context Rabbi Haskell Lookstein once said to me, which is that some people need reminding that passionate moderation is not necessarily the same thing as moderate passion. Passionate moderation is not necessarily the same thing as moderated passion. In other words, what we have to have is enough epistemological humility to declare, I don't know God's plans. And not only that, I would say, I don't know how God votes in elections. And that is a critique, by the way, in America, not just of the American Christian right, but also of swaths of the Upper West Side as well. And I want to make that clear. To return to Rhinus for a minute, I would add the aspiration to Miklat Batuach, to the land of Israel as a safe haven. Although the question of whether or not that has been achieved, or even is achievable given the neighborhood, is an open question, one which we'd be happy to talk to people about later. Sixth, what Tzionut Datit Acheret says is that the state of Israel must be unequivocally a liberal democracy. And I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about why, even though I suspect for most people in this room that's self-evident. As we saw last week, there are plenty of sources in the Jewish tradition that point in a democratic direction, even as there are many sources in the Jewish tradition that point in undemocratic and especially monarchic directions. Following Rav Hirschenson, David Hartman, Yitz Greenberg, and others, I want to emphasize, A, the, in a way, foundational idea in Jewish thought being covenant, and B, the fact that covenant is made between two free parties, even if the relationship between them is not symmetrical or even. That is, what it means for God to enter into a covenant with human beings is for God to enter into a covenant with human beings who are free, which is why, ultimately, the world needs to move beyond a model of manifest divine reward and punishment, because there's no meaningful freedom in such a world. Now, it's interesting that many religious thinkers, including many religious Zionists who have hesitations about playing out democracy to its sort of logical conclusions, often refer to the same line of Gemara, the same line of Talmud, one of the most famous passages in all the Talmud, Shabbat 88a, where the image is of Kafa Aleihem Har Kigigit, that God hung the mountain over the Jewish people's head and basically said, right, you can accept my word or I can drop this on you. Right? Now, that is, after all, not about human freedom. What is amazing about people who invoke this is, of course, that in the very next line, the Talmud dismisses this as a totally implausible model, saying, right, famously, in Cain, Moda'a Rabba Le'oraita. If that is so, the Torah is not binding. And as Rashi wonderfully explains, contract under duress is not a contract. There, in that piece of Gemara, it is precisely a rejection of Har Kigigit as implausible and actually theologically unacceptable. And not surprisingly, the Talmud reaches the conclusion, right, that the enduring moment of covenant between God and Israel, amazingly enough, is not Sinai, but Purim, which is, after all, a time when God's intervention and reward and punishment are, shall we say, less than manifest and maybe even able to be called into question. So interestingly, the very passage that many people invoke kind of as a push against the centrality of freedom is actually a passage that's precisely about the centrality of freedom. Judaism wants, in other words, a political system that values and respects the freedom and dignity, or maybe one should say the Tzelem Elohim, of the people who live within it. And as we now know unequivocally, I would say, democracy is the best way to ensure that. Recall also Rav Hirschenson's wonderful premise that he suggests should be the guidepost for every posek halakha. That is, Torah does not stand in opposition to the progress of civilization. What he calls Darchei Noam Shel Tzibilasyon Amiti, the ways of peace that are the ways of a real civilization. The Torah, he says, never obligates us to do things that contradict reason and insight. In other words, there cannot be, he says, a real contradiction between Torah and the best of modern life. And of course, we then could spend a great deal of time arguing about what constitutes the best of modern life. This is a hermeneutical principle, but it is not a rule, right? Or it does not actually answer specific questions. It rather articulates a light by which I should seek to answer them. One of the things that's entailed by liberal democracy is the absolute rejection of religious coercion, kfiat datit. I'm going out on a limb here sociologically, nothing has done more to alienate Israelis from Judaism than attempts at religious coercion. But I want to sort of suggest something very simple here, right? It is not just a political principle that means one has to reject religious coercion. It is a theological commitment to covenant and commandedness only being meaningful in the context of human beings freely choosing to engage with God's commandments. Religious coercion, by definition, undermines the religious value of that which is done in the context of coercion. Again, living in relationship with God is only meaningful and real when it results from freedom. Thus, a non-coercive regime is a mandate of a mature theology and not just of contemporary liberal politics. An interesting precedent for this, as I think David Hartman somewhere mentions, is Maimonides' discussion in the Laws of Idolatry of Abraham and Moses and their different modes of religious leadership, where Maimonides is very explicit that Abraham, who seems to be his ideal religious leader, Moses is in fact a leader who makes all kinds of compromises with human frailty. Moses uses force, but Abraham never does. Abraham's winning of converts is done purely by convincing people of the truth as he understands it. This led a variety of religious Zionist figures, Yeshayahu Leibovitz and Eliezer Goldman were two of the most prominent among them, to say, if you want to struggle for the Jewishness of Israel, you should fight for society and culture, not for the mechanisms of state. Or, as many people argue in America, right, you should engage in the question of religion and society rather than messing with the walls of church and state. Now, I would like to conclude by returning to Rav Kook. And very quickly, I would just like to share with you something that Rav Kook says in the introduction to the third volume of Orot HaKodesh, of one of the collections of his writing. He says something that I think is a kind of really powerful guidepost for anyone who wants to be a religious person, let alone a religious nationalist of any kind. He says the following: Asur li yirat shamayim shetitchak et hamusar ativ ishel ha'adam. It is impermissible, it is forbidden for the fear of heaven to push aside the basic ethical intuitions of a person. Ki azei na od yirat shamayim tehora. Because if the fear of heaven leads you to behave unethically, it is impure fear of heaven. Siman li yirat shamayim tehora, a sign of pure, good fear of heaven. Hu kisha hamusar hativi hanatua b'teva hayashar shel ha'adam holech ve'ole al piya b'ma'alot yoter gvohot b'ma shehu omed mibil adam. A sign of authentic fear of God is when your internal ethics, which are those intuitions are built into you by dint of being human, when those intuitions are deepened and made more real, raised to a higher level than they would have been without your becoming religious. Aval, he says, Im titzuyar yirat shamayim b'tchuna kazot shebelo hashva'ata al hachayim hayu hachayim yoter notim lif'ol tov. If you can imagine a fear of God such that without this fear of God, life in general would more lean towards the good, v'lo tzia lapol dvarim o'ilim laprat v'laklal, and would actually benefit more deeply both individuals and the society, ve'al pi hashpa'ata mitma'et koach hapo'el hahu, and if through the embrace of this kind of fear of heaven the power and the passion to do good is actually mitigated or dissipated. Yirat shamayim kazot hi yirat psula. This kind of fear of heaven is impure, and I think it's not a great exaggeration to say contemptible. So Rav Kook here, whose ideas have done and have been used to do a tremendous amount of damage, I think offers here a pretty important articulation of what it is we mean when we say that we embrace power to embrace sovereignty, and that we also remember to critique ourselves and to be morally self-critical for theological reasons at every step of the way. And I'll end by saying this piece of Rav Kook is maybe not primarily and not exclusively about Zionism or any other form of politics. It's actually about the more basic question of how does being religious and worshiping God affect and deepen my humanity? Thank you very much. Who has the mic? Oh, great. Yeah, Ben, please.
So at the beginning of the lecture, you talked about Moshe Una and how he uses humanism as a basis for, as a core basis for religious practices. Right? Then you said that he recognized that there's Shivim Panim LaTorah. There's like a variety of ways to interpret Torah, and that his is just one of them, and it seemed kind of postmodern, right? He understands that what he's saying is not absolute. But on the other end, it seems like he says that humanism is like this basis for it, and that all these religious values couldn't really happen without that. So how can he say both at the same time?
So I don't think he's saying, it's an interesting question. Here's what's not postmodern, okay? And in some ways is deeply anti-postmodern, and in this context it's a good thing, right? It's not that he's saying there are ways to interpret the Torah ethically and there are ways to interpret the Torah unethically, so choose one. Right? He's actually saying that there are values that are in some ultimate way true, in the light of which we are obligated to interpret the tradition. In other words, I think he would absolutely unequivocally be willing to say, my interpretation of the tradition is truer than Tzvi Yehuda's. He might descriptively be open to the possibility, as he says, right, that there are different ways to read the tradition. But normatively, he's not open to that at all. Is that distinction clear?
Yeah, but why is he, like, if you can read the Torah the other way too, why is he so sure that his way is the right way?
I think he believes Judaism has a history of acknowledging and even celebrating human beings' autonomous ethical intuition. To use language that I don't know if he uses, but later on in different ways David Hartman will use, Avi Sagi will use, that's the meaning of the story of Avraham at Sodom. Right? Is an attempt to sanction, and not just, by the way, to accept, but to actively solicit. Right? The story is about God's active solicitation of Avraham's own ethical intuitions that are not derivative of revelation. That's, I think, what he would say the answer is. And we should not be embarrassed about that.
Yes. We'll go the other way. I have an exegetical question and possibly a more direct theological one. The first is to get your opinion on the creation story, which you're posing as very universalistic story. One about the creation of the world and not necessarily Jewish people. Recently, looking at some Rashi, Rashi pulls out Reshit as appearing in a couple times in the Tanakh that specifically look at Am Yisrael and also Torah. And so I'm wondering if you think even in that first word there's implications about Judaism as being the central point. And my second question, which is more theologically meaning, which is the first one obviously also is, I'm kind of wondering where in your own theology is space for metaphysics, if at all. I sort of feel like Rambam just sort of like just beat out Yehuda Levi entirely, and I'm kind of curious to hear where you make space for that at all.
Okay, so I'm going to answer your first question and completely evade your second question in this context, only in this context. So the first question is, yes, so if you were to make, you know, you could, in some ways it's actually an interesting activity, make a list of the sort of canon within the canon of sources quoted by those who want to sort of fundamentally emphasize that the heart of Judaism is radically particularistic, and very high up on that list will be Rashi to Genesis 1:1, right? That is, the reason why God tells us about the creation of the world is to say, it's mine, and I give it to who I choose. Now, of course, one could also make a list of equally good universalist sources, and I would point out, with some hesitation but without a lot, that Chazal, I think, are pretty clear that, right, if Tzelem Elohim is Klal Gadol BaTorah, is the animating principle of the Torah, that itself is a guiding ethical choice by which we're supposed to read the rest. But, so that Rashi is important, influential, and I would say with all Yirat Kavod, with all honor to Rashi, has very little to do with the Pshat of Breishit 1. It is, right, it is a reading impacted by a series of Midrashim that Chazal create. I'm not sure that they create it for the same reason Rashi then runs with it, but the fact that there is a central Rashi that we're choosing not to emphasize, I don't find disturbing at all, especially since I, you know, am very willing to say, you know, there are lots and lots of sources and lots of different directions that one could quote. Again, descriptively, I don't think it's that Tzvi Yehuda. For me as a religious person, the painfulness of Tzvi Yehuda Cook is more painful precisely because I know he does have sources. I think there are certain things he did that he doesn't have sources for, but, you know, is there the potentiality in Torah for some pretty chauvinistic and even hateful stuff? Yeah. That makes it more painful. And that actually means that I think people have to step up and battle for what Torah should mean. And unfortunately, those of us who are aware of the complexity and call the multivocality of the Jewish tradition are often more sheepish about arguing passionately for a position than those who insist and are quite convinced that their view is the only view, which is one of the reasons psychologically why people in general spend so much of their time being fearful of what people to their right in various forms of left-right spectrum will say about them. Because people on the right tend to have no doubt about the rightness of their own views, whereas people on the left, I'm using these terms in a very loose way, but people on the left tend to be all about multiplicity. Except when they're not. But that's, okay? No, I mean that quite seriously. Now, as for the metaphysics question, what I meant, by the way, when I said that I was going to use Yoska Achi Tuv's term about non-delusionality without getting into the sort of philosophical piece of it, is that he's influenced there by the philosophy of a man named Eliezer Goldman, who influenced, I'm just going to say this in one sentence, because this is not, and then we can talk about this, influenced by a certain understanding of Wittgenstein, thought that religious claims made no metaphysical claims at all. Personally, I find that to be a not-so-convincing understanding of Wittgenstein and an even less convincing understanding of religious people. But it's a view that's out there. I am not committed to running metaphysics out of religion. I'm committed to trying to be humble about what I do and don't claim I know with certitude about metaphysics. There's a huge difference between those two things. When I say God, I mean God. Like the Ribono Shel'olam, the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Someone real. So, I'm not, you know, there's nothing post-metaphysical about the way I'm doing theology. There's something, I hope, post-arrogant about it. Yeah, please.
Okay, two questions. One, mentioning this. Historically, it seems that in every era where it's been taken more seriously, it's a cause of great problems. It may be important to maintain in our minds a distinction between the world that is and what we wish it to be. But beyond that, I wonder if we might be better off jettisoning the idea entirely. That's one question. And the second question is, with your version of religious Zionism, as you've described it, it seems that the gap between the quote secular and the quote religious is not such a chasm anymore. So I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Whether we should jettison messianism. So here, the sort of historian of religion in me and the religious Jew in me, I think, have some tensions that they are forced to work out. Meaning, I think it's true that certain forms of messianism, especially political forms of messianism, are dynamite. Not in the 1970 sense of dynamite, but dynamite as an explosive, right? Chomer nefetz, right? On the other hand, as you say, I think that it's funny. I would say that some form of messianism actually goes hand in hand with the notion of God's transcendence, in the sense that messianic aspiration is about a statement that the status quo is not what's ultimate. Right? The world as it is not the world as it should be. Where messianism becomes extremely dangerous, and this is where I think it gets interesting, is when people begin to say, I believe in the Messiah and he's already here. Because then, paradoxically, they end up sanctifying some version of the status quo. Right? So that's where it gets really interesting. I mean, Yitz Greenberg likes to say, and I'm not sure I would fully endorse this, but I would take it seriously, that the Jewish people have two tasks around the Messiah. One is to articulate that he will come, and the other is to insist that he has not come yet. And that's not, by the way, primarily a polemic against Christianity there. It's a polemic against absolutizing the present. So that's, I mean, it's not a totally convincing answer, but it's, in other words, it will never be my impulse as a Jewish person, let alone as a Jewish thinker, to say about any category, let's just jettison it. Because that's a form of rupture and discontinuity that I actually prefer in general to use only as the extreme last resort. I always want to find ways to find the holiness that is possible in the idea or the category. And I think there is holiness and possibility implicit in the category, even though I think it has been dramatically desecrated in our time. Now, as for whether it closes the gap, well, it doesn't close the gap. It does and it doesn't. What it does, I think, is make possible a conversation. And one way in which I think the gap is closable, not totally bridgeable, but is you can make it smaller, is in a context where religious thinkers can acknowledge that given the way that the world runs, one is not crazy or morally depraved to adopt a secular worldview. By the way, even a thinker as unmodern and ungenerous in many ways as the Chazon Ish, the great figure of 20th century Haredi culture, suggests at one point in his comments on Yoredeya that the category of heretic does not apply in our time because, after all, those categories developed in a time when God's miracles were manifest, and for whatever reasons, they're no longer manifest, and therefore those categories should be applied with extreme caution. So, all kinds of conversations then become possible. Because a world in which God is not manifestly evident, and a world that is godless, there is room for a conversation there. Ultimately, there is profound disagreement about metaphysics and about how one orients one's life, but you can talk to people. Whereas I suggest if you live in a sort of totally enclosed, what postmodernists pejoratively refer to as a totalizing narrative or a meta-narrative, the way that religious messianists often do, you can't have a conversation with anyone. You can only tell them they're not who they say they are. I'm totally willing to allow people to define themselves, I think. But I want to just say that as a religious person, sometimes that's not so simple. Because if you actually think that the good and God are intrinsically intertwined, then you are sometimes going to imagine that people who do good are in some way connected to God, whether or not they're aware of it. And then you're actually in this territory again. And I don't know my way out of that territory. I'm not sure that there is a way out of that territory, but there's obviously more to say about that. Yeah, Avi.
I do want to ask you to see if you can talk a little bit about something that you've discussed a little bit before, which is what should our relationship with religious Zionism, what should its relationship be with secular Zionism, especially given, as you said, this sort of increasing disillusionment from someone like Rob Cook till the present, where secular Zionism has failed to sort of manifest this kind of move towards a Jewish ideal, not only in a sort of religious sense, but in a, maybe like an ethical sense, but continues to be intimately involved with maybe the more problematic elements of Jewish particularism, like the military.
I'm assuming you didn't mean that the military is inherently a problematic aspect of Jewish particularity. It is a complex part of Jewish particularity. By the way, if that's not what you meant, we can talk about that too. I'm not trying to force my narrative onto you. Look, you know, I think it's... I might have mentioned this last week, but... you know, the way that I sometimes think about the rage of the Cookian circle at secular Zionists is, right, Ruff Cook basically promised them that secular Zionists would, right, maintain their idealism and jettison their secularity, and in fact, they jettison their idealism and maintain their secularity. I'm not sure that that's totally fair about everybody, right? It's actually not fair about everybody, but as a kind of broad category, that's how people around Tzvi Yehuda imagine, meaning we've gone from the people Ruff Cook hung out with in Yafo who were risking their lives to create a socialist community where everyone was fed to the cafes in Tel Aviv is a big journey, right? So the claim is. Now, I think that just as religious Zionism needs a reformation, secular Zionism needs a reformation too, in that it has largely exhausted itself, right? In that you have large swaths of Israeli secular intelligentsia who are basically, for all intents and purposes, no longer Zionists, and some secular Zionists who are really just kind of ethno-nationalists and sometimes in some pretty disturbing ways. The question is, if religious Zionism can be saved, I did not have tonight's lecture, can secular Zionism be saved? And I would say that it needs a healthy dose of a return to Jewish culture in a non-coercive way that assumes that the two models of Judaism that have been presented to it, namely right-wing settlements and Haredut, right, are not the only possible readings of the Jewish tradition. I take hope from the admittedly sociologically fairly insignificant re-engagement with Jewish sources and traditions that is beginning to emerge in religious Zionist circles. I like to think of that as the return of Acharaam, right? Acharaam, who was thought long dead, is actually back. And in the again, small but interesting emergence of a movement that is interested in using Jewish language for the pursuit of a just social order. That's not dead. If anything, I'm much more hopeful now than I would have been 10 years ago. I mean, I could say much more about that, but ultimately, since we're not talking about secular Zionism here primarily, but it's not like I think, oh, religious Zionism has to do tshuva and secular Zionism is just, you know, all hunky-dory and things are going great. There's enough tshuva to go around in the state of Zionism at this point. Okay, we'll take maybe, what time is it? We'll take one or two more, depending on how long it takes. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks. So I'm gonna put out a problem that I've thought about, and feel free to either agree or I guess it's a narrative. Feel free to agree or disagree with it. Another question that I think falls out from that, and I think it's interesting whether you agree or disagree with the first part. So, all right. That said, you talked a lot about I think in this and the last lecture. About looking to values in religious Zionism, and then even when you critiqued that position, both the discussion and the critique brought to my mind discussions that happen in the yeshiva, or used to happen in the yeshiva, and I'm sure it still do, about areas not having to do with Zionism at all, areas of halakha and the way we address halakha. So. I guess starting with Spinoza, people have had the idea that halakha itself is the major barrier to Jewish sovereignty. And I mean, that idea was in the back of the mind of many secular Zionists. But now there was an article in Azure recently that's been circulated about even religious Zionists seem to be asking the question, what's the relationship between the structure of halakha, the halakha as an entity, and political? That's the narrative. And my question is, some of the issues, especially in that Azure article, are issues that have been discussed in this yeshiva as issues that can be treated innovatively, halakhically. For instance, conversion. It's a big political problem, it's a big halakhic problem. So what do you see the role of the kind of halakhic project of Yeshiva Hadar and similar-minded institutions in religious Zionism? Or does it have a role? Do you want it to have a role?
Okay, so I'm now going to go on sabbatical and write that book. No. Okay, let me say a couple of things here which are just sort of like pointers to obviously what's a richer conversation. The first is, I do not understand why many critics of the Jewish tradition, including many secular Zionists, think that halakha is an obstacle to a healthy political life, and even, for many of them, healthy religious life. I would quickly add that Rav Kook, whose conclusions about how to do halakha and mine would be very far away from each other, also did not understand those critiques. Right? He thought that halakha had taken on a deeply exilic way of thinking, and that ultimately it had become impossibly small-minded and had ceased to be about anything. Okay? So I think that that's actually very important. I accept that critique, right? But the answer that I would be inclined to is to go back and reinvigorate a conversation about halakha rather than abandoning it to its worst practitioners, right? And I would say that in a different way. In other words, my relationship to Zionism and my relationship to halakha are not so dissimilar. I am aware that the way I understand what they are is, at this moment, not the dominant approach of those people who are committed to either A, religious Zionism, or B, halakha. I regard that not as a refutation of my ideas, but merely as a challenge to articulate them more clearly and forcefully. Right? So I'm prepared to battle for the heart of what religious Zionism is, although ultimately I'm aware that I also live in New York, so I'm ultimately battling for the heart of what religious Zionism is here. Believe me, that needs in some ways even more help than there, and there needs a lot of help, right? And I'm also willing to do battle for the heart of what halakha is and not abandon it to those who insist that they are the exclusive possessors of it. Meaning, in other words, that I think that a lot of the ways that halakha is understood by both Tzvi Yehuda Cook's circle, on the one hand, and many, if not all, contemporary Haredi poskim on the other, are deeply disturbing, and different models need to be articulated. That's why I work with Ethan Tucker. No, I mean, that's seriously, right? In other words, because I'm trying to, right? And that's why I chose to talk about Chaim Hirschenson, right? Who insists that, I mean, in that phrase I think I mentioned last week, this wonderful phrase, right? Halakha doesn't mean that I'm committed to the frozenness and fossilization of ancient social arrangements. Ein lemeidim min ha-matzavim ha-kadmonim, he says, right? We don't learn from those. Otherwise, the halakha would require us to live in tents, because that's where Yaakov lived, right? And certain aspects of contemporary Jewish culture gesture in that direction, right? And I don't want to go there. Meaning, in other words, I share all those critiques, but my answer to that is not to jettison, but to struggle for repossession and reinvigoration of those terms. To speak totally personally, I have been tempted in my life on many occasions to totally abandon the conversation about halakha and to abandon the conversation about Zionism. And I am unwilling to do either. Because Shivim Panim LaTorah and many of the faces of Torah that are currently articulated in the world, I find, shall we say, problematic to say the least. And I'm not prepared to cede authenticity to ugliness. I'm just not prepared to do it. Okay, to be continued. Thank you all very much.
The question is, do you see the relationship or the parallel between those two things as coincidental?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. If we had more time, it would be interesting to think that out. I don't know the answer.
That's
that was the main central question. Yeah.